Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Are you sick of staying in, or perhaps just generally fed up with announcements from the likes of Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings? Well, you might want to distract yourself for the next hour with this very special 80th edition of the Full Throttle Bike Racing Podcast from us here at Eurosport. First of all, hello from myself, Greg Haynes. I'd just like to say thank you very much to all of you, not just from me, but from Pete Burton as well, who puts in so much effort with the editing, the production and the promotion of the Full Throttle Podcast, and all of the guys back at base in London. Thank you very much, first of all, to all of you, and from all of us to you guys listening back at home, because it's been great to see the podcast build up since March 2018 when we kicked off. And as I say, this is the 80th edition. So thank you very much to all of you who have subscribed and continue to listen to this day. Please feel free to keep tweeting us at Eurosport_UK and Greg Haynes TV with any ideas, suggestions. And what I'd also be quite keen to see, actually, is pictures of where you listen to us from. Only the ones we can obviously retweet. Nothing inappropriate, please. But I don't know. Are you in your bedroom? Are you on the bus? Probably not at the moment on the bus, but you know what I mean. Are you on the beach? I don't know. Send us in your pictures and we'll be sharing and retweeting a few of those. Eurosport_UK and Greg Haynes TV. Now, to go along with this 80th edition of Full Throttle, I'm thrilled to say that Eurosport will be bringing you live bike racing action this weekend. Moto America has announced a provisional calendar kicking off at Road America live on Eurosport this weekend. So we'll be bringing you all of the action from the team there on site in the States. Jason Pridmore, Greg White will be there. We'll also have another commentator of theirs, Michael Hill, who also happens to be the World Superbike Paddock Show host, joining us on the show next week, as Michael and I will be digesting all of the happenings of round one of Moto America, which he's having to broadcast from his home in London because of the travel restrictions. So that's going to be interesting. But in the meantime, for episode 80, joining us is one of the most familiar voices in the British Superbike Championship. It's Larry Carter. He's been working for the organisation since the turn of the new millennium, celebrating his 21st birthday in the paddock this year. Hopefully we will get some racing. Watch out, hopefully, for a BSB calendar coming up very soon. The general feeling is we're going to get some action, quite possibly, across August, September and October. So let's just not say too much too soon, but keep an eye on the social media and on the websites for that. But in the meantime, Larry Carter, he broadcasts alongside the legendary Fred Clark. He works with BSB Radio. You can hear Larry's voice both on BSB Radio and also all around the circuit when you go to watch BSB trackside. And there's some real anecdotes coming up in today's show, I can tell you that. We've got the time when Shaky Byrne visited Larry and his unfortunate wife at 3 a.m. in their home. We've also got the time that Larry was literally run over very badly indeed at the pit lane in Donington Park in 2004. All of that and plenty more coming up in today's Full Throttle. And he's on the line with us now from Northallerton, about 10 miles up the road from the Croft circuit. Larry, first of all, I suppose I've got to start with a question about the coronavirus situation. How are you coping?
Hi, Greg. Yeah, we're okay. We're fine. Thanks very much. The situation is very frustrating for everybody, isn't it? When you go on holiday, you kind of know that there's an end date, isn't there, when you've got to pack your bags and come home. But the problem with the virus and COVID-19, coronavirus, call it what you want, is we don't know when it's going to end. That is the frustrating factor. We're Luckily, we're very healthy, and that's the first and foremost. And we're behaving ourselves and doing as we're told by staying in most of the time. But it's getting to the point now where we're rapidly moving through what is our race season, and with each and every passing weekend, we're losing valuable weekends that could contribute towards the championship. And I think just like everybody involved in professional motorsport, I would just like to get going, really. We've had all winter off, effectively, which is the usual downtime. And, here we are sort of like in spring when we should really be getting some indication as to, as far as BSB is concerned, two or three rounds into the championship and starting to think about, how the championship's going to pan out. But it's frustrating for everybody, but hopefully we will see the light at the end of the tunnel before too long.
Yeah, I must say, I'm missing you quite a lot, Larry, not least, of course, because of the brilliant supply of Palmer Violet sweets that you bring to the BSB venues and kindly give to me. I mean, I guess we're going to have a lot of those to catch up with, aren't we, when we do get back?
Well, anybody knows Scoop Carter knows that there's the infamous sweet cupboard, of course, which has the various goodies, never mind all this health food and stuff like that, is we've got a good supply of sweets. And for those people that perhaps don't know, is Greg, he spends a lot of his time in foreign shores, and they don't have Palmer Violet. So it just happened to mention at one point in time that how he loved these particular sweets. And I said, well, they sell them in my local shop. So it's now become a little bit of a tradition, is that just before a BSB meeting, I venture off to the local shop, get a supply of various other sweets and Palmer Violets and everything else, and drop them off in the Eurosport office where Greg is. And it's become a little bit of a tradition now. But they're all piled up here, Greg. When we get going again, there's a good supply for you.
It's very kind of you. And it does make a difference, doesn't it, when you go into the media centre or wherever we are at the track. Sometimes you need a bit of a sugar boost, don't you?
You need a boost of a lot of things. Usually the journalists in there, they can't get any work done for drinking tea and coffee, can they? That's usually the problem. But it's great. There's a good ambience at BSB right the way through the paddock. I felt I've had the privilege of working professionally in the paddock now for over 20 years. And, people come, people go. Riders come, riders go. Teams come, teams go. But generally speaking, the there is a paddock community there. And we all tend to look out for each other as well. I think that is the case. You consider that, in a media centre, and we don't reckon that anybody should do this, but you leave a lot of your valuable possessions about, don't you? We've got all our working equipment there that you sit next to somebody and you just, you leave your phone on charge and everything else, and you just know for a fact that it's going to be there when we get back. But generally speaking, the paddock is a very, very amiable community. Perhaps that's why I've been part of it for as long as what I have been, because I generally like the people that are there.
Indeed, I mean, there's so much to talk about. We've been talking for a few minutes, haven't we, before we've started recording, and we've been talking on Twitter in the last few days running up to the interview. But clearly, we're not going to get everything we want to into half an hour. But where do we start, Larry? Because anyone who's watched BSB on the telly will have seen you, of course, bumping into James Whittam on the grid walks with Eurosport. I'm often getting in your way, aren't I, for the ITV4 grid walks. Anyone who's heard BSB radio will have heard you, of course, alongside the one and only Fred Clark. You're there doing all the pit reporting. But again, as you said, you've been around in racing for a long time now. How did it actually all start? What was the first Larry Carter memory of car racing or bike racing? What's the very earliest memory for you?
It's a question I do get asked quite a lot, Greg. Firstly, there's no career plan, nothing like that. As as a kid at school, I was the most shyest introvert person that you would ever meet. I used to dread the teacher asking me a question, having to stick my hand up or stand up in front of class and answer
a question. Me too, actually. Yeah, I hated that.
Yeah, and for whatever reason, I hated that. My involvement with motorsport, I guess, stems back to my extended family. My mum was the youngest of a family whereby her three elder brothers competed in various ways, mainly scrambling, as they call it back in the day, motocross as it is nowadays, trials riding, grass track, that sort of thing. Never professionally, but they were, from what I could gather, they were quite good. And with living just, 10 miles up the road from Croft back in the 1960s and 1970s, where there was something on just about every weekend, I used to pester the life out of my poor auntie to take me to Croft, because obviously I was too young to go on my own, and I'd got this inkling for motorsport from somewhere. And she used to have to take me in her old Fort Thames van up to Croft. Mm. And whether it was bikes, cars, there was always something on. And it just kind of stemmed from there. My very earliest memories are from being trackside at Croft and watching racing, mainly cars at the time, right the way through to going through school. I never competed off-road or anything as a schoolboy, but you get a moped at 16. And then the next thing is that you're going to be the next world champion. And I have always been and still am a massive Barry Sheen fan. I didn't do the football and the cricket and the pop stars and things like that. I used to write Barry Sheen and draw Donald Ducks everywhere in my school exercise books, which I used to get into awful trouble for. And I was going to be, you know, another world champion. And so I got my Suzuki AP50 and we, with a group of mates, then all of a sudden we get some bigger road bikes, and it became rapidly apparent to me that I really did enjoy going quickly. I had a fairly serious accident on the road, which necessitated me to decide what I wanted to do, whether I wanted to ride more or less illegally on the roads or to take up racing, and that's what I did. I started racing in 1983, got lapped and finished last in my first race, and right the way through the next decade or so, we raced, and I'm pleased to say I got a little bit better. And ended up racing in the British Championship towards the late 1980s. And then, like most people, ran out of money and had to make a decision. And sadly, that was to pack it in. But I did want to, I've run my own team for 10 years, and I wanted to put that expertise to use. So I seconded one or two of the local hopefuls around here in North Allerton and the surrounding areas, and I helped them. I managed one or two teams and helped promote them and let the local newspapers and everything else know how they were getting on, to the point that people started contacting me and saying, instead of all these other guys, can you mention my mate in the local newspaper, and can you send some information out, and can you do as a press pack? And one thing led to another, and eventually I had to make a decision, because I was getting so much work effectively from the from the PR and communications and promotional side of it, that I ended up leaving my job to do that. Then that's what we were doing. We started out doing communications and press releases for people like Paul Bird, who'd spotted our prowess when we were at a BSB round. Rob McElnay was a good friend of mine and sparring partner from the Otter 66 Club, Paul Major. They asked me to get involved with a company called FORM, which is Federation of Motorcycle Road Racing Motorcyclists, and they started hosting press conferences at BSB rounds to try and emulate what was happening at Grand Prix. They asked me to go along, paid a little bit of my petrol money to go there, ended up going along there. And the next thing is, I got a tap on the shoulder from a certain commentator of repute called Fred Clark, which is the second part of the career. Fred didn't have his usual number two to do a podium presentation. Could I do it? Here's a microphone and off you go. And that was year 2000. And since then, Fred and I have more or less been a team at BSB, where he's the number one. He's the anchorman in the main commentary box, and I'm the roving reporter trying to get the news firsthand, hence why the nickname for somebody who gets an exclusive story is Scoop. And that was where Fred decided that my nickname should be, because I was the man going down pit lane and trying to rumble the stories out of the various people. And I'm pleased to say that the Fred and Scoop show, once we hopefully get this coronavirus out with, we'll be celebrating our 20th year together this year. So it's fantastic. And that's, you know, over the time, obviously, I've had involvements with riders in management roles and consultation roles and various other jobs that we've taken on in two wheels and four wheels. And it's been a very varied career over the past 20, 25 years or so, Greg. So, it's been really, really enjoyable. But no business plan to get there, no career plan, nothing like that. Yes, they do say that, you know, you don't have to be very good, you just have to be lucky, don't you? And I was in the right place at the right time, I guess.
I suppose, Larry, it wouldn't be right for us to proceed without just talking quickly about Fred Clark. I mean, how old is Fred now? I'm sure he won't mind us saying, will he?
He's an indeterminate age, Greg.
But I mean, Fred is a remarkable character, isn't he? And the energy he has, whether it's in the commentary or just when you see him around the circuit, he's one of the most enthusiastic people you could ever meet. And he's still just as sharp now as he always was.
You say you should never meet your heroes, don't you? Well, yeah, Barry Sheehan was my hero, and I met Barry on a number of occasions, and even had the privilege of interviewing him on the grid. Anybody that follows me on Twitter or Facebook will see me with my bleached blonde hair in my Demon Vimto shirt, where I was working for Paul Bird at the time, holding a microphone on the grid because Fred couldn't get anybody to do the grid interviews. And that was more or less when Fred and I started out. That was the year 2000, British Grand Prix at Donington Park, and I was interviewing Barry there. But Fred, if ever I rocked up at a race meeting, this gives you an indication how long he's been doing it, is, you know, I was still at school when I first heard Fred Clark commentating, and he'd been doing it 10 years then. Indication how long he's been. It's no secret, he started commentary in the mid-1960s, and he's still going strong now. And a race meeting for me wasn't a race meeting without Fred Clark commentating. Now, with all due respect to Eddie Dow and Eddie Fitch, Chris Carter and Dave Hardy and John Ward and Toby, everybody else that's been commentating, and the current incumbent of yourself, James Whittam, James Hayden, Jack Burnicle and company, wasn't a race meeting without Fred commentating. And Fred commentated on my career on a number of races that I did. And it was rather surreal when he asked me, and I'm kind of thinking, you know, this guy, this legend, wants me to work with him. And it's fair to say that, you know, that we've struck up a really good friendship as well as, you know, professional relationship, which has obviously stood the test of time, because we don't take ourselves too seriously, Greg. That's the first thing any BSB fan or paddock regular will know, that we're forever taking the mick out of each other or taking the mick out of ourselves or whatever. We do that, and of course there's the serious side to it, and, you know, we're never too flippant about things. But Fred and I have kind of formed a bit of a unique, double act's not the right word, but my name's Larry Carter, I'm known as Scoop. Fred Clark isn't Fred. Not many people know that his name isn't Fred. Fred is a nickname. His name is Peter Clark. And so we, you know, Peter Clark and Larry Carter rock up at a race meet, and then we have to become the Fred and Scoop show. And, you know, that's great, because, you know, it's obvious that, you know, if we weren't any good at what we did and people didn't like us, they'd get rid of us. It's simple as that. The fans would tell us we don't encourage lots of love-ins and things like that with the fans. We're there to do a job. We try and interact with the fans as much as we can. And from my perspective, I ask the questions that I want the answers to, knowing full well that it's the questions that the general public want the questions to. You know, Shaky, why are you off the pace this weekend? What's the matter? You know, now I may know that he's fallen off his mountain bike during the week, and he's been riding with a broken collarbone, which nobody knows about. You know, the Scott Redding saga at the start of last year was something where nobody had to know about this broken femur of Scott's, which obviously been part of being included with Paul Bird's team in pre-season testing, where I was sworn to secrecy. I couldn't tell anybody that Scott had this broken leg. And, you know, the journalist side of me wanted to make sure that mitigate the reason that Scott's perhaps not as high up the leaderboard as what he should be is because he has got this problem. But, you know, you're not allowed to do that. Well, you know, Fred, he's great. I always say, where would we be without him? It's a difficult job. You're a very good commentator in your own right, but Fred is unique. His knowledge is the sheer history that he exudes. And I can set him a little task by saying, do you remember the British Grand Prix in 1977, Fred? Oh, yes, good. Yeah. And he give him a few minutes, and he will have a reference to that in written notes. He's covered over 2,500 meetings, I think we reckoned in that time. And he has notes, Greg, of every race from every race meeting, whether it's a club meeting or whether it's a Grand Prix, World Championship meeting or anything like that. He can look and he can then put a note in saying, on lap 3, so-and-so took the lead. On lap 5, so-and-so fell off. Lap 7, so-and-so developed a machine problem. And so-and-so won. And you've heard of the illustrious Baldrick. That's Jeff Judges. That's his lap score. It has been for many years. Well, what Fred does is he takes Jeff's notes home on a weekend Jeff just writes a lap chart and notes down things like so-and-so retired or so-and-so fell off or whatever. And then Fred will just dissect them notes into his own little shorthand and file them away in his file. Doesn't have computers and stuff like that. It's all done manually. And hence why if you ever see Fred Clark with about four suitcases, then they're not flawed or anything like that. They're all just literally his notes over 55 years of commentating. So,
and his TV monitors as well, of course, Larry, because Fred does need to make sure he has good quality pictures through from the TV pictures and the timing screens. He brings his own screens to the events, doesn't he, just to make sure he's got good enough TVs.
Experience over the years has taught him that not to rely on things. He brings his own stool and, there's all sorts of... At some point soon, Greg, I am going to write a book with Greg.
Oh, good. That would be good.
It is something that we have tentatively discussed. I've actually made a start of my own book, not that anybody wants to read that, but just for the sake of getting a little bit of experience. I've been asked by one or two people to help them pen a few memoirs, and I thought, well, best do my own first to see what it all entails. So we're halfway through doing that. But at some point in time, I think that... Fred, it needs to go into writing, and that is something that we've very, very tentatively discussed over the past few years. And it's something that if he wants me to help him with that, I'd be very, very privileged. If if it comes to fruition, then great. But as my mum used to say to me, you'll miss me when I've gone. And I think that's the case with Fred. Is we take him for granted, and we have done for a long time. I spoke to him a couple of days ago. He's on good form. He's very frustrated like the rest of us. That we can't wait to get things going, and he's up for it again this season. And let's just hope that we do get some action, whereby commentators and people like you and I and Fred are needed rather than behind closed doors and stuff like that. And we can fulfil our 21st year together, because I'm pretty sure that Fred's wanted to go on for a little while yet. He's in good health. And, he's still got all his marbles about him. I do query that sometimes, of course, Greg, as you well know on air. But especially, and of course, the political rantings. What would we be without the political, party political broadcasts on behalf of the Fred Clark Party at times?
Well, that's the thing. Obviously, there's a lot of time to fill between sessions as well, isn't there? And for anyone listening here on Full Throttle who doesn't know, if you go to BSB Radio Online or you go and watch the live timing on the British Superbike website, you can actually listen to the audio there as well. So you can listen into Larry's interviews in the pit lane and Fred's commentary. I often do myself, actually, when I come in on a Friday, Larry, I'm often listening in the car coming down the motorway or wherever I happen to be to hear what's happening at the circuit with you guys. And it's great. It's a really good way to catch up with what's going on.
I think one of the, there's two broadcast mediums effectively, isn't there, Greg, with when it comes to covering British Superbikes. So we just use British Superbikes for the time being. One, of course, is via the Eurosport feed, where yourself and, the teams are involved with that. And that, of course, is audio as well as video. And the other one, of course, is via BSB Radio, whereby Paul Marcel, broadcaster Paul Marcel, and last year we had Kerry Cobb involved with us, myself, Fred Clark, we have Jeff Judges, we have our sound engineer Mike Rump, and that is transmitted online. And if you don't have facilities to access Eurosport, then as you rightly say, whilst there's no pictures there, there is the audio. And from when we go on air at 9 o'clock in the morning, usually on a race day, it has been a little bit earlier sometimes, right the way through until the last race is finished or the last qualifying session is finished at 6, sometimes later than that on a night. It is wall-to-wall sound, barring one or two adverts and other little interruptions that we get, but it is and over the past 15 years or so since we've introduced BSB Radio in its current format, then it has been a big success. And we do get a lot of people interacting with us, sending the messages in. And, as you know, Greg, my company does most of the race programs, and we usually put a little caption competition in there to email or text the radio station in and things like that. And it dovetails all very, very well with the product, which is BSB, and one would hope the thoughts are that if we can get going this season, when we can get going this season, I'm pretty sure that that the promoter Stuart Hayes, Jonathan Palmer, and the rest of the team, they will be looking at the various ways of which to broadcast the championship to the general public. Now, hopefully, then people will be allowed, into race meetings by the time we go. The social distancing will have been relaxed, and we can get 30,000, 40,000 people into the various circuits towards the end of the season. But if not, and you know, we have to run, or they have to run behind closed doors, which is definitely not a favoured option, I don't think. Then of course there's Eurosport and hopefully BSB Radio to, you know, to relay the goodwill and the messages back to you know, to the people who are not able to get along to race meetings, you know, through being isolated or for whatever reason. So hopefully we can continue for a good while yet.
Yeah, and touch wood, that will be sooner rather than later. Now,
that was you
things...
touching wood there, wasn't it, Greg?
It was. That was the desk. Yeah, there it is. we'll see what happens there. Now, Larry, over the last few days, of course, this going out on Monday, but over the weekend, we've put a few tweets out, haven't we, about the fact we're going to be talking for the podcast. And obviously you've responded, and there's some tremendous anecdotes, which I must admit I've not heard before. So I'm very much looking forward to these. So I'll just reel through what you've put on Twitter and you can tell us the story. So you've
Bear
written
in mind, it is for a family audience, Greg.
Exactly. As you put it, that's it.
Haven't we? Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
We might have to do an uncut version, Larry, at some point. So yeah, there's the first one where you've put, you've written that yourself. I'll keep the stories clean for family audience, apart from the time me and Michael Rutter shared a bed in London. So what's that all about?
Yeah. Well, anybody knows that Michael Rutter and I have this love-hate relationship. He loves me and I hate him. It's one of them things. Me and Blade, we're really, really good mates. But it was Michael that started this habit, if you like. When Old Scoop was there presenting the podiums and doing everything else, it was Rutter that decided that rather than drinking champagne or spraying champagne, I should be the person to wear it. Well, it then became... they weren't bothered about winning races, Shakey and Rutter and Easton and company. It was just who could soak me on the podium the most. And literally, I have been absolutely... If I'd have fallen in the swimming pool, I would have been drier. But and Rutter's always playing practical jokes. Well, we went to the Ali Pally show, as it was back then, and I'd arranged to pick Michael up. Michael, who lives in the Midlands, and he obviously didn't want to pay for fuel to go, given that I was passing his doorstep. So I arranged to pick him up at Leicester Forest East Services. And we went down to the Ali Pally show, and it became readily apparent when we were checking into this hotel that the organisers had booked us that there was far too many bums and not enough seats, effectively.
Oh, no, classic.
For the job. And I remember Leon Haslam was there, there was James Toseland there was Chris Walker there was Leon's sister as well, who'd organised all the promo girls for the show as well through this agency. So there we all were, at this little hotel in one of the Muswell Hill, I think it was, and it became rapidly apparent that we couldn't all stay anywhere. There was no other hotels in the vicinity. It was quite late in the night and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, we said, well, we'll all have to double up anyway. So we went and Michael looked at me. He said, well, I'd best share with you then. So we went into this room, which was half the size of a normal room, and there was only one bed. Now, at this point in time, as much as me and Michael were good buddies and we, you know, got on really well, there's no way that we were sleeping in the same bed together. So it was a case of either we go out for some food, and then the first one back, of course, gets the bed, the other one has to sleep on the floor, or neither of us went out or whatever. Anyway, we decided that we would go out, went out for a meal, drown out sorrows and everything else, and came back to find nobody in the bed, which was like quite a relief for me. I thought Michael must have, you know, managed to get some other accommodation. Anyway, there's me. I get ready for bed and goes to pull the covers back. And what's Blade done? He's emptied the entire contents of the hospitality tray in the bed: the coffee, the tea, the sugar, the condensed milk, everything else. So anyway, that precluded me from sleeping in the middle of the bed. And so the long shot is that he came in chuckling and doing everything else a few minutes later, And I can't remember the exact outcome, but suffice to say, me and Michael Rutter, there was one bed for the all evening, and in the centre of it was all the coffee and the tea and everything else which he deposited, which I don't think he thought that he would have to sleep in the same bed anyway. I think we both ended up on the floor that night. But anyway, that was me and Rutter. Just another slight anecdote with Rutter was at another place we were staying at, a Castlecombe Grand National meeting. We're all in the same hotel. This time we did have separate rooms. And it became readily apparent that when I met Michael in the restaurant later on, he charged all the meals and drinks that him and his party had to my room, thinking that I didn't know. It turns out that somebody gave me tipped me the nod on that one. So
another scoop for you there.
On my party, I made them all the most expensive things on the menu. And little did Michael know until he checked out that we charged everything to his room, and his room was 100. His bill was 100 quid more than what mine was. So
you had the last laugh. I've got to say, with the bed in London, what happened when you checked out of the hotel? Did you never get a bill about that or anything afterwards?
Well, because it was we were booked by an agency to provide. I was there to provide a chat show at the Ali Pali show, and all the riders were guests and everything else. So it was an agency that had booked us all the rooms, and obviously they hadn't realised that there was as many people there and there wasn't enough accommodation for them. So we just checked out, didn't say anything, and we never had a bill for it, put it like that. But suffice to say, it's the one and only time I've shared a four walls with Michael Rutter overnight. Although that said, you have it on your list, there was another incident with Michael Rutter in the middle of the night.
Yes, is this the 3 a.m. visit at home from Rutter, Easton and Byrne?
This was the infamous one on an evening. Three British champions, Shane Byrne, Michael Rutter, and, well, you can't say Michael because he's never won a British championship, the only man never to win a British championship. In fact, the rumour has it that he didn't even win the egg and spoon race at the local sports when he was a kid, as Michael, but anyway.
I'll tell you what, Larry, I'm definitely going to get Michael Rutter on a podcast very soon with the right to reply, I think.
Well, two British champions, Shaky Byrne and Stuart Easton, as well as Michael Rutter. Anybody that may follow motorcycle racing in the north of England knows of an organisation called the North Yorkshire Road Racing Supporters Club, whereby I'd had an involvement in the very early days with a good friend of mine called Chris Herring, and we'd kind of set this club up, which the idea was to raise funds through chat shows and raffles and everything else, dinner dances, and give some money to local racers to compete. And it's still going to this day, some, 35, 40 years since it was organised. Anyway, Blade, Shaky and Ratboy had all been to one of these chat shows in North Allerton, and I obviously live in North Allerton. We'd all had a couple of drinks and what have you, and we'd said our farewells on the night. And I'd gone home and I'd had a couple of sherbets as well. Now, it's fair to say that Stuart Easton wasn't drinking, because Stuart was the chaperone for the evening. And Stuart, the couple of weeks before, had come to pick me up in North Allerton because we had another local promotional job to do. So he remembered where I lived. And so
this is going to be terrible.
So Michael, Shaky and Stuart were staying in this local establishment where the rumour or word got out that, well, you know, oh, that was it. They couldn't find anything to eat. It was midnight and all the local takeaways in our little two-star town here all shut at 9 o'clock or whatever. And they were hungry. They couldn't get anything to eat. The bed and breakfast wouldn't make them anything. So Stuart, in his wisdom, said, well, I know where Scoop lives. Why don't we go and see Scoop, see if we can get a sandwich? Anyway,
three o'clock in the morning, Larry.
The idea was vetoed. Eventually, hunger got the better of them. And the next thing, I'm in bed, and I'd had a couple of half shandies as well. And I thought we heard a knock on the door. My wife, Sue, said, I think there's somebody at the door. And I obviously couldn't really be stirred. She was trying to wake me up and look, Larry, I'm sure there's somebody at the door. And I'm looking at the clock. It can't be. It's 2:30, 2:45 in the morning. And so I turned over and went back to sleep. And so Sue, my brave wife, decided to go down and answer the door. And the dog cowering behind her and everything else. And at this point, I'd come to my senses a little bit and realised what was happening. And I'd ventured down the stairs with my dressing gown to hear her saying, "Get in this house now, all three of you." And she'd answered the door, and she'd seen Stuart there, and she'd seen Shaky there, and then Michael Rutter appeared from around the side of the door with a bottle of wine as a peace offering, which he'd won in the raffle, and saying that they were hungry and they couldn't get anything to eat, so would we be able to make them a sandwich, or would Sue be able to make them a sandwich?
So
all three of them were lined up on my sofa, and she duly made them all a sandwich. And she said, "When you've had this sandwich, you leave and you don't make any row, because we're in a very, very quiet residential area with lots of kids and lots of old people. And you don't make any noise whatsoever. And you go, and that would be perfectly good." So Shaky Rutter and Stuart sat on my sofa in North Allerton, all eating a sandwich. And they finished off, and Julie left. And we went to switch the lights off and headed back upstairs, whereby in the little cul-de-sac that we lived, you thought the Monaco Grand Prix had kicked off.
Oh, no.
Stuart decided that he would do a couple of donuts in the hire car that he'd got, and rev it up, and a few handbrake turns and everything else. Well, one by one, the lights went on in the street, and bit by bit, eventually no. They disappeared. And I was walking the dog the following morning, got up complete with a little bit of a hangover, and a very friendly little area that I live in, but it wasn't very friendly that morning, because I had all the neighbours out with purple faces asking me what the hell had gone on at our house that night. And the most vocalist amongst them was a guy who lived a couple of doors away from me, who was a bit of a big bike racing fan, and he also used to ask me about bike racing. And I said to this guy, I said, "Well, I'm terribly sorry. It was some friends of mine who turned up, and it was a big practical joke, blah, blah, blah." And I said, "You won't believe who was in this car." And this guy was, he was looking at me daggers. And I said, "It was Michael Rutter, it was Shane Byrne, and it was Stuart Easton." And his mood changed. And he said, "I'll tell you what." He said, "These things happen." He said, "If you could get me their autographs next week," he says, we'll say no more about it." So we were at wherever the following weekend, and needless to say, all three of them were laughing about it. So I got them to sign. I think it was a race winner's cap at the time, and give it to this guy signed by Shaky Rutter and Easton. And he was happy enough, but about 2 months later he left. So the sale sign went up. The 3 a.m. visit for a cheese sandwich at our house by two British champions and Michael Rutter.
Well, I feel for Sue on that one, I think, more than anyone. The closest I can get to that is driving a rental car back to the airport in Jerez after World Superbikes in 2017 with Shaky Byrne alongside in the passenger seat. And we're going round a roundabout, left-hand drive car, obviously, because we're in Spain. And all of a sudden, I'm thinking, what the hell's going on here? And it feels like there's a puncture or something at the back. The car started to lose grip at the rear. Of course, Shaky had only gone and pulled the handbrake on, hadn't he, in the middle of the roundabout. But that sounds like nothing in comparison with some of the other stories you hear.
Well, again, these are stories. I have a thousand like that, but that was quite surreal. This little cul-de-sac in rural North Yorkshire, where all three Grand Prix riders, Rutter TT winner, Shaky Byrne World Championship race winner, Stuart Easton British champion, all this sort of thing. It's the last thing you expect three top racing stars to rock up for a cheese sandwich at 3 o'clock in the morning. But anyway,
absolute carnage. I mean, what were you thinking? Were you laughing at the time, or were you thinking, "Oh no, please go away"?
A mixture of everything, because the devil, the renegade inside me, thought it was quite funny waking the street up. But if I had a school age kid there that had been walking up at 3 o'clock in the morning, because these of course take place during the week, the chat shows, and this was a Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, so all the kids had to go to school the following day, and all the dogs were barking at this point in time. And I found it quite funny, it's something that, again, not a lot of people know about, but it was quite funny when it happened.
Now, another thing quite a lot of people probably don't know about is that I think you, unlike most people, Larry, have actually successfully been ridden over in the pit lane. Was this Donington, I think?
The year was 2004. I'd been doing this job for 4 years. in pit lane, and again, I managed to. You've been up and down pit lane nowadays, where it's very, very regulated with the amount of people that are allowed in pit lane. Mm. It's a very dangerous environment when you've got motorbikes and everything else was in past year.
And especially in your case, you've got headphones on as well.
Because you've got no, because you've got your cans on and because you're listening to what's going on, you don't have that perception that there's a motorbike just in your vicinity. And I have been clipped a couple of times, foot pegs, ripping trousers and things like that. It's, we've been close on one or two occasions. Well, this particular time was 2004, and it was the latter stages of what we would now call Data Tag Extreme Qualifying. Mm. And of course, everybody is out there trying to get out on track and get a quick lap in. And James Ellison, it was, who was riding for the Bernie Tolman Gentin squad, and he was running as a privateer that year when the championship was divided up into what we would call works bikes and cup bikes. And he was riding for Bernie Tolman on the Gentin Yamaha, just come back from a couple of seasons in the World Championship at James. And it was a few minutes to go, and I was halfway down the pit lane at Donington Park, and I was reporting what was happening, and that James Ellison was just putting a new rear tyre in, and he was going back out, and Yukio Kageyama had just left pit lane, and John Reynolds had just done this, and Shaky Byrne had done that, and everything else. And I was kind of a third of the way across. If you can imagine the pit lane being, the nearest is the pit the pit garage doors, and the furthest across is the pit wall. Well, I was kind of like a third of the way out from the garage doors. And I had my wits about me. And just up in the distance, probably around 100 metres away, I could see Ellison just leaving his pit garage. Of course, he was quite keen to get out onto track. And just as James was accelerating away, he was on my trajectory. And the idea is, over the years, is don't try and get out of anybody's way. Just if you move, you're more likely to get hit. If stand, engage a rider with eye contact, and they will miss you. And 999 times out of 100, it works. Except just as James was accelerating away, he happened to look behind him. The sort of thing that you would see when a rider is leaving pit lane. How just for 1 or 2 seconds they just cast their eye back in the direction of the riders on track, but by this time accelerating away, of course the 50 or some meters to me had become virtually nothing, and I'm stood there just waiting for James to cast his eye back in the right direction, and it didn't come in time, and I thought, well, I've got to do a split second decision here. I've got to dive out of the way because at the speed that he was doing, again, I'm not sure what the pit lane speed limit was at the time, but it would be around about maybe 40 or 50 miles an hour. It doesn't sound very much, but I jumped one way, and by which time James had, just to say, started looking to the direction that he intended, but it was too late, and he hit me. And he pulled the brake on a little bit to arrest the speed, but he bundled me base over apex, down pit lane, head knees, doing a personal impression of an Olympic gymnast. whereas James's had fallen off the bike, and the bike had ended up against the pit wall. And James, who was leading the Privateers Championship at the time, was, I seem to recall, laid on the floor as well, which he'd hurt his leg.
What a scene of chaos it must have been.
Yeah, and I remember thinking, I picked myself up. There was no pain. I remember that. There was no pain. Mm. But I was aware that there was a lot of blood about. I'd ended up, he'd sort of like pushed me as far down as Jack Valentine's garage when Jack was running the Valmoto Triumph team with Craig Jones that particular year, and I think Jim Moody as well. And the first person on the scene was Annabelle Webb, who's the starter, and Annabelle's been part of BSB for a long time. Her parents are still marshals in pit lane. Her granddad was Harold Kopok, who used to be one of the major sponsors back in the 1960s and 1970s. And all I remember was Annabelle coming and picking me up and bundling me into Jack Valentine's garage and sitting me down on a chair there where I resembled a casualty from Hamburger Hill. There was, I'd broke broken my nose. I've broken a couple of fingers.
Oh dear, really?
I'd knocked a tooth out. I'd split my lip. I'd skinned my arms, my elbows, as well as just, you know, the shock of it all. And
that sounds like a terrible accident. That was a really bad one.
It was. I was quite shook up about it. But I said, I'm okay. And I looked at my cans on the floor, and quite simply, Greg, without putting too fine an emphasis on it, they saved my life, because my cans had gone down on the side of my head, my temple, effectively. Oof. And the substantial cans that you were wearing at the time, not like the little earphones that you wear now, had effectively taken the impact. They were absolutely smashed to smithereens. I was, you know, relatively speaking, I was okay. In which case, James had picked himself up, come into the garage to see if I was okay, and James was quite distressed about it. And I said, "Yeah, I'm okay, James." You know, which case they insisted that I go up to the medical centre and get checked out. And I didn't want too much of a fuss at this. I could see I needed a little bit of bandaging up or whatever, but I was more concerned that I was going to miss the final 5 minutes of qualifying. So anyway, I went back to the med centre, and which was at Donington then, as it is now, underneath the grandstand. And they patched me up, and they, you know, they wanted to send me off for X-rays for a suspected broken collarbone and suspected broken fingers and things like that. And all I could remember, Greg, was there was a race at the end of the qualifying session. I forget what race it was now, but there was a race which I thought, I need to be there to officiate at for the podium. And the doctor there said, no, you're not going anywhere. You're going off to hospital, if anywhere. And I'm saying, no, look, there's another race here which I need to get to.
And this anyway, is all with a broken tooth, broken fingers and all the rest of it.
Tadi Okada's got a wonderful picture on some social media sites where there's a picture of him. He was running the Honda team at the time. And I'm all bandaged up with all my war wounds, and Taddy's pulling her face, laughing at me and pointing at me. But the worst thing about it was my poor wife Sue again, who at the time she was in the media centre, and there was this oohs and ahs, everything else, and she'd say, and somebody said, "Oh, what's happened there?" And somebody had said to Sue, "Oh, she said, I think a marshal's been run over in pit lane. Don't know." And Sue had carried on with the business in the media centre or doing whatever she was doing, not knowing that the said marshal was me, who was by now in the medical centre getting patched up. James and his girlfriend at the time had come along very distressed and asked if I was okay, because, of course, James thought he'd killed me. But anyway, we got bandaged up, and we managed to get back out again. And I'll have it be known that I did do the final podium of the day.
Did you really?
I was battered, I was bruised, I was very, very second hand. We managed to get back out and do that. The funniest thing from my point of view was what I got told afterwards was the following day. You can imagine I was like a boxer that had gone 12 rounds with Mike Tyson. I was absolutely battered and bruised and everything else. I could hardly get out of bed, and getting in the bath that night with all scrubs and everything else was good fun. But at the time of when it happened, Fred had had some people up in the commentary box, and I was broadcasting at the time, of course, and the microphone just went dead.
So you were actually talking, were you? Was it in the moment of impact? You were actually talking live? Wow.
Yes, I was talking, yeah. I was in mid-floor when all of a sudden it was as if you'd just dropped a microphone, for argument's sake, and there was a little bit of background noise and whatever, yeah. And Fred, just off the cuff, just said, "It sounds like Scoop's been run over."
And
he cast his eye out of the window, 100 yards beneath his commentary box, and he explained... Scoop has been run over. that was my near-death experience with...
Is that recorded anywhere in terms of Fred's audio or the video of it? Is there any footage?
I think it was 94, Greg. I think it was just before, a couple of years before, we started doing the BSB radio, so I'm not sure that it would be. I don't think we were Ofcom regulated back then, so I'm not sure that there would be. But quite often, Fred, that's one of his favourite analogies, is when we're talking about things, he said, the day that I looked out of the commentary box and saw you flat on your face, Scoop, he said, I must apologise, I did laugh, but I didn't realise quite how badly you were injured. But anyway, that might be the title of the autobiography, Greg. It sounds like Scoop's been run over. So, yeah. That's three of my experiences. I have literally a thousand others. The day that we were in on the April Fool's joke for Shaky Byrne, that we told him that there was the inaugural Donington Park Omnibus Grand Prix, whereas we were getting all the various leading riders from various championships around the world as celebrity London bus drivers around the Donington Park circuit. The only problem is they couldn't go under the Dunlop Bridge, so they had to put an off-road section in to bypass it, and there was going to be promotional work in London, and the start money was 20 grand, and there was prize money down to last place, and poor old Shaky, I got everybody in on it. I even got some of our broadcast team at Eurosport, the likes of Barry Notley and Craig Doyle and people like that who were working as broadcasters at the time, to ring Shaky up and do this. And we got official letters drafted up from Donington Park to ask him if he'd be involved. And poor old Shaky, this went on for weeks, Greg. This went on for weeks. And the more it went
on... I'm so glad I know this story. This is fantastic.
The more it went on, the more even his team boss at the time, Paul Bird, said that, you know, he wrote to him releasing him from his contract to do the inaugural Donington Omnibus Grand Prix, and everybody was in on this. It was an idea that Steve Parrish saw in my head, and I just thought we can do this as an April Fool's joke. And
there's a surprise if Stavros was involved.
Then it went on and on and on, to the point that when eventually I had to let Shaky down and say, look, Shaky, this is all a big wind-up. I don't think he spoke to me for about 3 months, but that was back in the day. But
did you let him know privately or publicly in some sort of interview? How did you break the news to him?
Well, this was of course before social media. This was back in the round about 2004, 2005, I think it was. So the likes of MySpace and things like that, the Friends United, the original social media sites, they weren't as effective as the modern day ones. And I think I had to ring him up eventually and say, look, Shaky, this is all a big wind up. And when somebody just goes silent on you at the end of the phone and you don't know whether they've come up or whatever. But and he said, I'll get you back, Carter. I will get you back for this, Carter, and a number of occasions. I was subject to a number of Michael Rutter-esque soakings on the podium, I think, after that for a little while. But Shaky, he's been a good friend over the years as Shaky. He's a guy that we've in our 10 years at BSB, our paths have crossed on a number of occasions. And just beforehand, we were talking, Greg, about how some riders, when they go off to other championships, sometimes it goes to the head a little bit, and they forget who the people are that were their friends. Well, I can honestly say that Shaky Byrne has been one of them guys that has been Shaky Byrne from the first day he raced the Superbike back in 1995-96 for the Harris Brothers as part of the Fast Bikes team, right the way through to his current career in broadcasting. Shaky Byrne is the same Shaky Byrne. There's no airs and graces about him whatsoever. When he was in Grand Prix, World Superbikes, all that sort of thing, he was the guy that used to run out of the garage to talk to me rather than me have to go and find him. Whereas a lot of people, as anybody knows, trying to get interviews with riders at World Championship level is virtually impossible for people like myself. Shaky used to be another one of those twins. There are another two like that. Tom Sykes, Leon Haslam, people like that. I've never ever forgotten the roots, but that's so refreshing.
Very, very
so
true.
Refreshing.
But I look forward to some of those anecdotes with Shaky this year. Hopefully some more Shaky Show podcasts and some commentaries together maybe at some point. But I will definitely, without any shadow of a doubt, thank you very much, Scoop, be mentioning the the Donington Omnibus Grand Prix at some point to Shaky later this year.
One of the promotional activities we had lined up for him was to be a bus driver around Trafalgar Square.
And he agreed to that, did he?
Yeah, all this was agreed to. Fantastic. I think it might have even been called Richard Coventry, who's the director of the TV shows nowadays. There was Coventry, yes. There was Ben Miller and one or two other people. We were all in on it. You know, we'll provide a uniform, Shaky. You know, you just need to drive the bus. Have you ever driven a bus before? Well, we'll get you some lessons. And there was all this to the point that the more people that became involved with, as I say, I think Stuart Hicks might have been involved. I know Paul Bird released him temporarily from his contract to do these sort of things. And we'll send a camera down. What was his inside leg measurement and jacket size for the bus driver's suit and all this? It was, you imagine it's like on the buses, guy, like Blakey off on the buses.
Yes, yeah.
It was one of them. But poor old Shea, I don't know whether it was the 20 grand first prize that swayed him or the 10 grand start money or something else like that, but
I would say that had quite a lot to do with it. Yeah,
definitely up for it was Shaky. I noticed it went well. I've not seen reference in any of the books to it yet, but anyway, it's something that happened.
We'll make sure of that.
He might just have erased it from his memory because it was too painful, Greg.
That's tremendous. What a great anecdote. We'll come back to that for sure. Just before we go, Larry, we did talk a bit about the rallying, don't we? Because you're a pretty quick driver and co-driver yourself alongside Paul Bird, even on a world championship level.
Yeah, it's my round of golf. I have a little rally car. Other people know I traditionally just use it. We, in a normal season, we flat out, aren't we, Greg, from sort of like February through to sort of November time. Yeah. And, you know, so you get 2 or 3 months off after that. And luckily, up at my local track at Croft, that's when there's 2 or 3 little rallies on. So I have a Peugeot 206. I've had it for a number of years now. It's not expensive to run. And we'd go and have a play, invariably in the snow or in the rain or in the wind and ice and everything else. But, yeah, it's good fun. But prior to that, I did co-driving. Living up here in the remote North Yorkshire moors, we have forests on our doorstep. And, of course, those forests were home to the Lombard RSC Rally and other events for many, many years. So most people in North Yorkshire are brought up with the sport of rallying. And we've, you know, as kids trekked around the forest in the middle of the night watching Mark II BD escorts and stuff like that. And I've always had a passion for rallying and navigating. I've always loved maps since I was a kid and, you know, plotting routes and stuff like that. Really enjoyed it. So when the opportunity came to co-drive with a couple of friends of mine, we managed to do it. We did a couple of seasons in the national championship and really enjoyed it, to the point that at the time Paul Bird, who was just sort of like getting acquainted with at the time, said he fancied doing a bit. Could I find somebody who might hire him a rally car? And I managed to find somebody. And what about co-driving? We couldn't find a co-driver, so I would have to do. So anyway, a couple of years down the line, Paul and I did the British Championship. We did okay in various events. Won a couple, and it culminated with us doing the British Round of the World Rally Championship in 2001, the Network Q Rally GB. Where Paul was driving, I was co-driving, and it was the year of Colin McRae's infamous role in the Martini Ford, yes. If you remember.
Yeah.
And I think when we went past it a couple of hours later, I think it was still smouldering anyway. But we got to the finish. We managed to use our good friend Tony Jardine to win the media award. And as a result, we went across the finish ramp with the likes of I think Marcus Cronin won it, and the Richard Burns finished the second, and Gary Rubenpera, people like that. All these top professional drivers, and the old chicken farmer from Cumbria and the North Yorkshire journalist managed to go across with them because we'd won the media award with my job. We finished 39th overall out of, I think it was something like 130, 140 competitors. We had our trials and tribulations along the way, one or two little offs and one or two little set twos that me and Bertie had in the car. But apart from that, that was an ambition realised, Greg. You know, seeing the likes of Hannu Mikkelstig, Blomqvist, Bjørn Vondergaard, Henri Toivonen, Jimmy McRae, Russell Brooks, people like Roger Clark in the local forest. Never ever did I think that I would ever get to compete in a rally car, let alone be a winner of a Class of the World Championship event. So, yeah, really, really good times. And eventually, I got Birdie sacked me. He told me I was no good. Eventually, I told him I was no good from the start. But Paul went on to a very successful career whereby at one point in time, he was ranked number 2 in the UK to a certain Colin McRae.
Wow.
So, yeah. And his son, of course, Frank, is now involved in the sport, both circuit racing and rallying. And whereas Paul was a damn good driver, not a patch on his son. His son is phenomenal. Frank,
I commentated on Frank, funny enough, for a Formula Renault Eurocup race in Barcelona at the end of 2017, and he's very quick, isn't he?
He is. I'm not sure the single-seaters are his forte. When I've said that to Paul, he went right the way through Formula Ford, or Formula 4, as it is now, and right the way through the Formula Renault Eurocups and into F3 and things like that. And Frankie never really, for my money, showed his true form when it came to the open top. Sticking with a car with a roof on it, he changes colours. He's won a couple of endurance races with the Sicily Motorsport team out in Abu Dhabi and another one in the Far East. He's going to be driving for the factory Bentley team at a number of endurance events this year.
Wow.
And as far as the rally is concerned, he won 5 rounds out of the 8 in the Motorsport News Circuit Rally Championship. When you consider that at the start of the season, the guy never sat in a rally car before and he ends up winning 5 of the 8 rounds. He's,
wow.
He's a bit of a talent, his young Frank, but you can't get a word out of him. He's a man of very, very few words, his Frank, but with a little bit of luck, a little bit of his dad's guidance, and who knows, you might be seeing a future Formula One star with Frank.
Yeah, we'll keep our eyes on that. Well, Larry, we could go on and on and on, couldn't we? And we'll definitely have to do some more podcasts. We'll have to get Fred Clark involved. I'd like to speak with your wife, Sue, at some point as well to get her take on events.
But in the meantime,
poor Sue. But that would be great to have a chat with Sue.
Well, you will know Sue. You will know Sue. I mean, she marks X for no publicity. But for those people that don't know, especially those that are involved in BSB, she, for many, many years, has been involved with the podium ceremonies. She's the person that passes the trophies to the dignitaries to give on to the riders, and she's the one that has to go and headlock the riders to get them onto the podium at the correct time. And along with various colleagues, Holly Haminder and Karen and various other people like that, my job doing the podiums, I couldn't do it quite simply without them. And poor old Sue, she's been seconded in on about the past 10 seasons now to do that. Invariably, she's out in the windswept podium in the rain and the wind and getting soaked in champagne and everything else. And the poor lass does it because I ask her to. So it makes my job so much. And she's the one that sticks the notes through the door for the Eurosport team to tell who the presenters are and all this, just to try and make it look that little bit more professional as well. So, and she's, we've been together nearly 40 years now. She understands what motorsport is, you know, how it's involved in our lives. We were there when I did my racing as a raw teenager, spending every penny we had between us. And, here we are. As soon as we get going again, we'll be there trying to keep our end up in Pill Lane on the podium.
Well, Larry, thanks ever so much. Look forward to that. Thanks for the funny stories, especially the one about Shaky. We'll definitely come back to that. And hopefully I will see you in the not-too-distant future.
I'd best put Shaky on block or something, because as soon as this comes out, I don't know, there's only one person who's going to ring about that, isn't it? But no, my pleasure, Greg, really. And keep up the good work. You know, since you've come into BSB, been a bit of a fresh air. And I think most people like your commentary style. You like me. You like your stats. You like your facts. You do an awful lot of work beforehand. Mm. And unlike, some people who just rock up and expect it there, you spend a lot of time. I realise that the amount of time that I spend doing all the stats and everything else, you're only as good as that information, and you've certainly spent a lot of time. Hopefully at some point in time we can have a chat over a beer at a race meeting, and I think a lot of people will go for that.
Yeah, well, thanks very much for that, Larry. I really appreciate it. And definitely, because we don't have much time to really see each other, do we, at race meetings, apart from when we're either live on the telly or you're live on the circuit
or
PA on the radio.
Each other on the grid.
That's what we're usually doing, isn't it? Yeah.
Which is when my next door neighbour normally sees me. I say, I'm not doing my job properly if I get on TV. So, but no, it all works. All works well. And I think, yourself and James and us all, we all appreciate each other's job, I think, when it comes to that. And if, I realise that, live, when you're doing a live grid walk for TV, you can't stop and redo it. And that's why I just dip out and go back to a rider when necessary. And I think there is that appreciation of each other's jobs. And, it's why it works so well.
The thing is, people like it when we bump into each other anyway, don't we? It all makes the show, really.
Just to love that little bit, we'll have to do a little bit of a dance next time, Greg. That'll get them talking.
Yeah, we will. We will. We'll have to, we'll both ask each other a question and then we'll both move on. We can feature on each other's grid walks.
The grid statistical quiz or something. What's Greg going to ask?
That's a good idea.
What's Scoop going to ask Greg?
We'll have to try and do that.
it all works quite well, and it's all you know, a high pressure environment, you know, where the riders are under so much pressure. We perhaps, you know, just try and enlighten it that little bit, because we're under an awful lot of pressure as well. Mm. With you with directors in your ears, me with, you know, the timing schedule where we've got to play the, you know, the intro music and everything else, and you know, there's a lot of pressure that goes into it. It doesn't just happen, does it, Craig? But it seems to work quite well.
I hope so. Touch wood again. Somehow it does. Yeah. I'll see you there very soon, I hope, Larry.
Yeah, hopefully, Greg. Good to speak, mate.
And you just get the feeling we haven't heard half of it, don't you? We'll definitely have to make sure we get Fred Clark on the show in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much again to Larry. Scoop, of course, as he's known. Don't forget to follow him on Twitter as well. And if you've actually listened to the podcast because you're a subscriber, have a look on Twitter, because Larry's tweeting a newspaper cutting of that time when he was run over by James Ellison in the pit lane at Donington Park. So you can see the person who thought it was a rather amusing accident at the time. Have a look at that on Larry's Twitter. And don't forget to listen to him, of course, on BSB Radio and Trackside if you happen to be at a BSB meeting anytime in the not too distant future. In the meantime, thank you again from me, Greg Haynes. Thank you from all of us here at Eurosport. Next Monday, we'll be into June by then. And Michael Hill, the World Superbike Paddock Show host, who, of course, is a Moto America commentator, will have been broadcasting from his home in London for that action, which is happening this weekend at Road America, live on Eurosport. All of the live Moto America action. Finally, we're going to get some bike racing to watch again, and hopefully more. Well, let's hope we don't have to wait for too much longer. But hopefully this has taken your mind off a bit of the carnage that's going on in the world of politics, certainly in the UK at the moment. And the general negativity we seem to have in the news, which doesn't seem to be getting any better. And great chat there with Larry Carter. Finally, don't forget, if you haven't subscribed, you can on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify. You can also find the full archive of all of the podcasts going back to March 2018 with James Whittam and Shaky Byrne and various other guests we've had recorded either from home or recorded in many cases in the commentary boxes at the various circuits we go to for BSB and World Superbikes as well. Thanks again from Greg Haynes, and we'll be chatting with Michael Hill here on Full Throttle, episode number 81, coming your way next week. Until then, look after yourselves.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.